Hi everyone, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black. And now the Exit Coach Radio Show proudly presents the All-Star Review, a compilation of one-minute highlights from past guests. Hear more one-minute highlights and full interviews from these guests at ExitCoachRadio.com.
When your business value is wrapped up in your client list, what's the most important thing you can do to drive the value of your business? We asked expert Stacy McKibben.
If you don't have really strong, you know, client relation management tools, CRMs as they're lovingly referred to, if you don't have tools like that in your business, it's going to be very difficult to transition it over. As a matter of fact, your next buyer is going to use that as a reason to drive down your sale price. Absolutely, one of the biggest areas of opportunity that we see in professional services businesses are going back to your existing and previous clients. Oftentimes, we just forget that they don't necessarily know the full breadth of services that we provide and how they can use us or even refer us to their friends and family. So that is a big win in most businesses, is just starting there. And it's very difficult to do if you don't have a good system in place with which to do it.
One of the most common ways a business is sold is through something called an earnout. And we asked for information and an example from business broker Chris Bond.
What buyers want to have happen is they want a seller to prove the actual value of the business by having them be patient and waiting for a piece of the payout. So in other words, once the transition period has happened, say 6, 12, 18, or 24 months, the buyer will make additional payments with the comfort that, okay, it is what you said it is. Had a very creative deal earlier this year where down payment was made for about 80% of the deal. A bank stepped in for a percentage of the deal. The seller actually financed another small percentage of the deal. And the earnout comes in years 3, 4, and 5. So everybody's pulling in the same direction, making sure the first 2 years go very smoothly.
What are some of the challenges for leaders in this knowledge-based economy? Here's CEO Coach Bill Anton.
The person that has the most influence over the entire organization is the person that leads the organization. And transforming that person exponentially influences change. My training as a psychologist, my understanding about the kinds of organizations that are going to be successful in the future are going to be organizations that realize that knowledge is their product and that knowledge can only be created by enrollment, not by compliance. And so the task of the leader of the future is to transform the people that work in the organization so that they want to give their best and so that they're willing to offer ideas and perspectives that create knowledge and innovation for the organization.
Medical insurance is a big part of your budget. How do you contain those costs? We ask benefits expert Rhett Bray.
We'll talk about wellness, is how we can start to communicate the importance of the wellness and that we give the people and the employees the opportunities to do things that will help them to become healthier. We start to educate them on the importance of annual physicals. We start to educate them on preventative care. Women do this quite well. Men have a tendency to wait till body parts don't work and then they go, which can be late. And it's interesting, we take better care of our car. We change the oil. We see the lamp light comes on, and for a lot of us, we don't do the maintenance that we should do on a regular basis. That will identify a lot of issues that people have that now you can start to address either through medication, through exercise or diet. There are just a few key areas that you can identify that will drive these higher costs.
Okay, so we've heard the term before, treat your business like an investment. It'll be a lot easier to sell down the road. What exactly does that mean? We asked an expert, Don Berzin.
Many of us in the field encourage owners to look at their business as an investment. Some owners understand that concept, but many do not. I mean, for a number of them, they see their business as either a job, a cash machine, a passion, or an extension of who they are. And the term investment sounds a little too removed for them to relate to. And we also let it be known that a business is actually easier to sell when it has a passive ownership. I mean, an owner who is not personally critical to maintaining future cash flows. But let's face it, I mean, one of the last terms that ever come to mind when we think about most entrepreneurs is passive. You know, these people are doers. They make things happen. And sitting on the sidelines is not something that many of them want to do at any stage of their career.
At ExitCoachRadio.com, we're interviewing over 100 top advisors to get you one-minute tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new content daily at 6 a.m. and 1 p.m. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
Why would you have a revocable living trust instead of a will? Here's attorney Matt Amaro.
One of the main reasons that you would consider doing a revocable trust versus just having a will is avoiding what we would call a probate process, which is a court proceeding to distribute a family estate, which can be very expensive and legal fees, court fees, and just involves a lot of court involvement that can be pretty painful. So by using a trust, you can get out of that. Now, if your assets aren't high enough, that's one way you may be able to avoid probate without a trust. And the other way is you may have assets that are able to pass to beneficiaries outside of a trust and outside of probate, even if you don't have a trust. But when you have real property, you usually won't be able to avail yourself of those two exceptions to staying out of probate.
How do most people decide it's time to start exit planning, and what's on their mind when they do? Here's Jim Immel.
Long term is really interesting. I use the analogy of the light switch. Sometimes these business owners don't think about it, and then all of a sudden they wake up one day and they just want to turn the light switch off, and they go from being passionate 100% into the game, and then all of a sudden something starts feeling heavy. Maybe it's a personal situation that's happened, but they literally turn the light switch off. Most of the people that you and I work with, it's more like a dimmer switch. They just don't do it that quick. They do it over time. But what really a lot of them are thinking about is, how do I transition myself out of the leadership position, provide other people opportunity to get into that leadership position, so the business is being prepared to transition from a position of strength and not weakness.
People are nervous about stocks and bonds these days. What's the outlook for income real estate? We asked real estate expert Scott Tamkin.
I'm a firm believer that income property will grow wealth over time. And there are parts of Los Angeles where income property is still affordable. The west side of LA doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but there are parts of LA where there are still opportunities. And I firmly believe that, particularly in some of the outlying areas, the gentrification will continue and people will want to rent in those areas, particularly as public transportation expands. People have some extra money. They're looking to invest in income property. I would say good strategy might be to join up with others who are doing the same. There are some crowdfunding sites that offer some opportunities to do that, but I would be careful just jumping in and talk to an expert in the multifamily business. I think over time it will prove to be lucrative.
Protecting your assets is important, but when you do it is even more important. Here's attorney Harry Barth.
A very important component to understand is that, as with all business deals, asset protection being just one of them, is to be able to settle a proposed claim within reasonable limits. It's very, very difficult to do that if you are in jeopardy of losing your home, losing your business, and losing your life savings. So I think that it's important that asset protection is granular. We look at the various components. We take into consideration all of the goals and objectives of our particular clients. And there's not one size fits all. Every situation is different. Every background is different. Every family makeup is different. Every business transaction is different.
What's the best way to use Twitter and other social media? We asked expert Tim Templeton.
I just had a friend ask me today, I don't really get Twitter. What is the value? And I said, you know, it's two things. It's self-promotion, or business promotion in this case, and it's research. So if you want people to know who you are and what you're doing, and you create content, you create blog content, you want people to see it, one of the best ways to get it out in front of people is to send out an announcement using Twitter. Likewise, if you're trying to find people in your ecosystem, your business, the analysts, the resellers, the potential partners, You can find them by their activity on Twitter. You can interact with them. You can follow them. You can retweet things that they're sending. And you can create a relationship that way, which is a lot easier than it used to be.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Hey, thanks for joining me today. It's a real pleasure to have you with me. I have with me today a very patient man, Todd Palmer. We've been trying to connect today. It's not easy sometimes, you know, when technology doesn't work out. But Todd has graciously agreed to join us today. He's an executive coach, keynote speaker, author, and CEO. And his key focus is helping entrepreneurs and small business owners and C-level leaders live a life by design. Now, Todd went from being a struggling entrepreneur with $500,000+ in debt to making the Inc. 5000, a record total of six times, as one of America's fastest growing companies. He's a CEO of Extraordinary Advisors, as I mentioned, and we're going to talk about how to deal with some of the things that are going on these days with COVID and maybe how to ditch your comfort zone a little bit on some of these issues. So, Todd, thanks so much for joining me today.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much for having me on the show, Bill. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. So, Todd, tell us a little bit more about your background and your story about going from deep in debt to building one of the America's fastest growing companies. That's pretty fascinating. It takes a lot of ambition and, you know, kind of confidence in yourself.
Well, it's interesting that you choose the word confidence, Bill, because that was something I really lacked at one point. You know, I started my company, like most entrepreneurs, with little to no startup capital. And 10 years in, you know, we had some highs and we had some lows. And the company I owned was Diversified Industrial Staffing in Detroit, Michigan, the Metro Detroit community. And we were a temporary help company. And we were kind of like a lot of other temp companies at the time, just struggling to survive. Very focused on the revenue play, not the margin play. And I had a couple of clients stiff me in bankruptcy. They discharged over $240,000 in debt due to other choices and other mistakes that we made as an organization. I made as a leader. We got $600,000 in debt. I was 2 months away from running out of all of my money. So using the word confidence, I was not having a whole lot of confidence during that time frame. And I finally raised my hand, decided that my imposter syndrome, my itty bitty negative committee wasn't going to run my business anymore, wasn't going to run my life anymore. And I hired a coach. The coach came in, taught me some quick financial literacy, pointed out some of the holes in my ship, so to speak, that I was taking on water. I realized that I had the wrong team in place. I had allowed a lot of toxicity in my organization to permeate. And on September 9th of 2006, I fired my entire company and I started the business over. From there, we figured out some inflection points within our space, decided to go for some skilled trade sectors that were being underserved and underutilized, increased our margins by about 10%, reduced our payment terms from clients from 120 days down to about 12 to 14 days, and eventually dug out of that debt and went on to make the Inc. 5000, again, as one of the fastest growing companies in America, six times. So pick up some confidence, thankfully. But I had a lot of humility. I made a lot of mistakes. And I realized that I had a lot of stuckness, just like in COVID times where a lot of people were dealing with change and uncertainty. I was living with that way before COVID ever hit.
Yeah, that's an amazing story, Todd. It really is. And congratulations on coming back through that. I think there's a lot of people that listen to this show that are thinking, you know, I've been running the business as kind of my own personal pocketbook. Not, you know, typically a small business is not run to generate a lot of profits because that means paying a lot of taxes, right? And then we have companies that say, okay, well, now I want to make my business attractive to a buyer or I want to monetize my business, so I need to transition.
Sure.
But a lot of them have been doing what they've been doing for so long. They're in this habit of just getting by is okay because you don't have to pay a bunch of taxes. And there comes a point, and I want to hear from you on this, there comes a point where you just say enough is enough. I need to make a big change in what I'm doing. Where were you when you made that decision? You were just about, you know, like you said, you're burning through your money, and you made that decision that enough is enough. I'm gonna hire a coach and I'm going to get out of this mess. How did you do that though? How did you take that step?
Well, it's so much it was self-exploration, self-awareness. You know, I was from the generation of entrepreneurs in the mid-90s who, you know, we thought, we were told, we believed that we could, you know, a rugged individualist mindset. And we weren't into yet. We, you know, Tony Hsieh hadn't written his great book about the scaling of Zappos and how culture was important. So we had this rugged individualist attitude. Simon Sinek hadn't come out and talked about what was our purpose? What was our why? I just had connected with a gentleman by the name of Vern Harnish and read his book, The Rockefeller Habits. That was a real pivotal point for me in seeing how other people had done it. There was not a lot of knowledge out there and how to do it. So I thought the right way to do things was to do it alone. I thought I had to be the oracle. I thought that the only person who could do all this stuff was me, and I was flat out wrong. And I decided really to stop building more of a lifestyle business or stop building a job and really grow and scale a company so that I could, you know, feed my family. I was a single parent, and it was important for me to be able to create a great life for my son and I. As I rescaled and retooled the businesses, I had, you know, 12 to 18 families that I felt responsible for my employees. And I found, honestly, and I think this may resonate with a lot of your listeners, is I actually got better ideas from my staff when I got out of the way. I figured out I had to speak last in the room, not first, to solicit the best ideas, because 12 people going in one direction was a whole lot more powerful than me going in one direction, pulling 11 people with me.
So that's a lot of change right there. That's a lot of change from saying it's not just all about me. It's about these families that I have to feed, and hey, they're on this ride too. And there is knowledge out there. There's a lot of knowledge. You mentioned the Rockefeller Habits, and that led to, of course, an entrepreneur operating system and traction and all that kind of stuff. A lot of people are doing that. But how was that transition? I mean, did you ever fall back to, like, you know what, this is new, doesn't feel comfortable, this is your comfort zone speech, I guess, right? Getting out of that comfort zone.
Oh, absolutely. And I did fall back. And it was, I had to make friends with failing and failing forward. I had to recognize that failure wasn't a final step. And every mistake I made, my coach was great at teaching me that every mistake I made was a learning opportunity. Every mistake I made was a pivot point, you know. And so he really focused me on being intentional, not expectational. So many of us, I specifically, was very much focused on a win-lose mindset. And so when I pivoted to an intentional position, more opportunities became clear to me. So I'm $600,000 in debt, and I'm running out of cash. He's like, we will find a way out of this. We just don't know how yet, but create the intention around that. Then when I created that intention of getting out of debt, I started putting in place different strategies that tied to that intention. Then my mindset shifted from a closed mindset to a growth mindset, and I saw a whole lot more possibilities. And my team then was able to make mistakes in the office without fear of being fired, without fear of repercussion. We would celebrate the mistakes. Hey, we tried these three things. One of them didn't work, but two of them did. Let's keep the two that worked. Let's start moving forward. You know, I have this client of mine I'm working with now. They were so wrapped up in a mindset of, I don't want to make mistakes. Well, this leader replaced two of his key leaders. His revenue within the 12 months after that grew 70%. But the biggest thing for him was his profits grew 500%. He was able to add more people to his team. He's now doing less and enjoying the business more because he shifted his mindset and figured out he didn't need to be the oracle like I thought I had to be and have all the answers for all the people all the time.
That's really great. I think it's really important for people to hear stories like this, Todd. And I think it's really great that you get out there and do that. And of course, you're a keynote speaker, and you're an executive coach, and you talk with people all the time about how they're feeling and dealing with this. What's the reaction you get from most people when you talk about, yeah, that you did this? Do they say, yeah, you did that, but I just don't know if I can?
Well, and you know, that's so great you point that out, because a lot of people will practice what I call the law of avoidance. I'm a lifelong learner. I'm an avid reader. And one of my favorite authors is a guy named Mark Manson. He talks about the law of avoidance. And we will talk about wanting to do things. We will talk about wanting to make changes. And we don't do that, even though those changes, whether it's changing our business or adding to our leadership team or maybe getting rid of an unproductive employee or even, you know, losing weight, we don't do those things because our sense of self, even if it's a negative sense of self, is so rooted in who we are, we have to shake that up and get out of that paradigm. And it's often wrapped around, well, I will do it once I just get motivated. Well, the reality is, and the neuroscience will show, that we only get motivated once we take action. Even if we take the wrong action, taking an action will then create a motivation off of that. And, you know, I coach people around this, and I love working with my clients and getting them unstuck. But to be honest with you, I get stuck occasionally too. So I still use a coach, and I bounce ideas off of him. And he's one of the world's he's literally a brain surgeon. He's a neuroscientist, MD, who talks about how to get out of reactivity into creativity, because that's where people in general get stuck, whether you're a parent or whether you're an entrepreneur. It happens to most of us. It's important to recognize that it's not if it happens, but when it happens. And there are tools out there and there are resources out there to get yourself unstuck so that you're able to get to ultimately that life by design that many of us are seeking.
So I guess when you talk with him and he says it's not brain surgery, he really knows, huh?
Oh my gosh, I love that. That's so true. It's so funny. I remember seeing him speak, and I'm in the audience, and I raised my hand and said, he's talking about his theories and he's talking about his practices. And I'm like, oh, come on, really? That sounds, you know, too easy. Prove it. Because he was talking about in the lecture about how we don't have to necessarily go back to childhood to fix our problems. We can make changes quicker. And I'm like, you know, being in therapy as I have been through the course of my life on and off, I was a doubting Thomas. And he showed this video about how he could ask you questions and you're in an MRI machine and your brain's going to fire differently. Then he showed the video of him asking questions, the brain firing differently, and people coming out with changes that could be implemented right now, where we could start talking to ourselves differently. We can start talking to others differently. We can start talking about, again, intentionality versus expectation. Now, approaching things with, you know, tools like massive curiosity. I'm doing a speech next month in Mexico virtually, and they're having me come and talk about how we can take this entrepreneurial mindset, apply it to parenting, because entrepreneurs have such a high rate of divorce and dysfunction within their family. So these tools about how to think differently and how to approach things in a different way versus a traditional way are going to, I think, especially coming out of these COVID times, are going to have a ripple effect around the world, both, again, in the entrepreneur's business, but also in the entrepreneur's family.
Yeah, that, very good point. A lot of times the attitudes get, of course, taken home. And, you know, if you're positive at work, then you'll likely be positive at home. So what I hear you say is that, you know, there's a big difference between I'll believe it when I see it and I'll see it when I believe it.
Well, for sure. And part of it is having, you know, it's like the Stockdale paradox that Jim Collins talks about in his landmark book, Good to Great. Deal with your brutal reality and have faith that you will survive it, and allow yourself the creativity to try several different things in order to survive it, to get out of it. And, you know, during these tough times, it's amazing how many entrepreneurs are so wrapped up in looking for the one quote unquote right answer. The only way to do things. And, you know, they say, well, you know, what's the magic potion? What's the silver bullet? And so much of it is literally putting one foot in front of the other, trying something today, seeing what works, seeing what doesn't work, communicating that to your team, communicating that to your staff, leaning into, not away from, uncomfortable conversations with employees, with vendors, with family about where your business stands, where you'd like it to be, where are the opportunities within the tragedy and how you can move towards those, and being okay with trying something and having it at work and learning from those steps. Because it really, and this is what my coach, his name is Danny Friedland, talks about constantly, is failure really is a non sequitur. It really doesn't exist. Because if you try something and you learn from it, and then you apply what you learned and you continue on that path, then you never ultimately will fail, because you're constantly learning, constantly growing, and constantly progressing.
Excellent. Well, your enthusiasm is contagious. I really appreciate you coming on and talking about that. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about your book, The Job Search Process. There's a lot of people that are in transition out of work, maybe, and thinking about how they're going to get back into a good, productive job. Maybe it's a good time for a change for a lot of people. What can you tell us about how to deal with the COVID-19 and moving forward from where you might be if you're looking for a new job, or if you're unemployed, or you're just searching?
For sure. And I think there are people that are unemployed who could really benefit from a career change, because there are companies that are hiring. A lot of companies are hiring. But the hidden part about it is 85% of available open jobs are never posted or listed anywhere. I was a recruiter for nearly half of my life, and we knew that there were companies that would tell you publicly that they're not hiring, but if you sent them the right candidate for the right open position, or you send them the right candidate who could be a revenue generator, they would actually talk to them. They would add them to the team. I mean, we turned our business around during the recession. We made the Inc. 5000 every year during the recession as a growing company in the manufacturing sector with 13% unemployment at one point. So there are jobs out there, and I would tell anybody seeking a job is, first thing is, network the heck out of that thing. Tell everybody you know that you're looking for a job. Tell them what makes you a great employee. Why should somebody talk? And then recognize that there's a massive hidden job market that's not on Indeed, not on LinkedIn, even though Indeed or LinkedIn are great tools. I'm not saying don't use them. Use them, plus create your own job search strategy, like I talk about in the book, of going out and figuring out what companies do you want to work for? How can you market yourself to them? What should your resume look like when it comes to deliverables? And those deliverables should be data-driven. If you're in sales, how did you increase the sales in your territory? How did you improve the margins within your business if you're a COO? If you're a CFO, how did you increase not only margins but reduce costs? Put numbers to those, because in today's world, that's what hiring managers are looking for. Certainly go through HR. I'm not anti-human resources, but in addition to that, go on LinkedIn. Figure out who's the person you'll be working for within that organization. Reach out to them. Send them your resume. Contact them on how you can be an added value to their team. And I guarantee you, like the book talks about, you can get a new job within 6 weeks or less.
That's fantastic. And, you know, when you say that, I think about how many business owners I talk to that say, we're always looking for good people. We just don't, we're not necessarily actively or posting, you know, we're not putting that on the job search board anywhere. But, yeah, if you know anybody that's a good person, we'd love to talk to them. So I agree with what you're saying 100%.
And it's been that way forever, and it will be that way now. It's like I was blown away by a client of mine. They've added 7 people over the last 8 to 10 weeks. They're in hiring mode because there's great talent on the street, and they want to snap them up now before they return back to their former employer. And they're recruiting them, and they're bringing them in, and they're courting them almost like they're dating. They call it like their dating process. And they've been able to add some key players that were employed back in January.
So when you in your book, The Job Search Process, of course, you outline all of these steps, and it's something that, you know, everybody can get a hold of and read and learn from. But when you're talking to on the employer side, do you actively now act as kind of a matchmaker for them and say, we know a lot of great people. How do you interact in this, or is your role now, you're an executive coaching and speaking and thought leader. Are you still actively in the employment business, I guess I should ask?
No, I'm really not. I've been out of that active duty for about 3 years now. So what I do is I often teach the employees when I speak from stage or even on teleconferences or Zoom calls. I teach them how to go out and find the hidden job. What I teach the employers on the other side of it is, how can you make yourself the incredibly attractive employer of choice, especially for hard to fill jobs? What do I kind of pull the curtain back for the employer, and do this a lot for manufacturing companies because they still have something that's a very fixed old school mindset. And how can you attract a millennial? How can you attract your next generation of talent? What's going to make you that employer of choice? And there's so many things that they can do at little to no cost around culture, around, you know, cost-effective training, around giving millennials a voice in the room but not a seat at the table. Millennials, for example, are looking for a couple of things. They want to have a voice in decisions. They want their opinions heard. They are often recognized and realize that they're not the final decision maker, but they want to be heard. They want freedom and flexibility. And now, specifically with COVID times, what they wanted 8 to 12 months ago, which were, you know, almost forbidden, we've got to see everybody. You've got to be working in the office. You've got to be putting in your 40 hours where I can physically see you. Well, that's changed. that's shifted. And if employers are willing to embrace those shifts and change, I mean, you know, my son's a great example. He's a CPA. He works in the Metro Detroit area for a company that is based out of Toronto with hubs in Detroit and Houston. And he only sees his teammates, his supervisors, his boss on teleconference. And he's doing a great job. He's putting in his hours and he's adding value. And if that company only had, we're going to hire, the mindset of hiring people locally, either in Toronto or Houston, they wouldn't be going after their largest sector, which is the Detroit growth market.
It's a huge time of change as far as that's concerned, too, for a lot of employers. They because they're getting used to working with employees virtually now, they can expand their reach to find good people all over the place. So it's important to be attractive. And on the other side of things, as you were talking, I was thinking it's also so important for employers to know how to keep their best talent, because they could easily be picked off by people looking for good talent. Now, it's a great time of change, a lot of opportunities, and I can tell by the way you speak about this that you have a lot of passion about this and bringing great knowledge out. So tell us what you're available for right now. Are you available for keynotes and speeches and coaching gigs, as well as just generally talking with business owners one-on-one these days?
That's primarily what I've been doing since COVID hit, because it's crazy. I was going to be on 6 different stages across 3 different continents, and then they all got shut down, and I'm doing everything remotely now, which is actually really fascinating. I've expanded my reach. I've spoken in Malaysia and Australia and Brazil and all across America and Canada, and it's such a true pleasure to watch people have light bulb moments and to get unstuck around their businesses, around their hiring choices, et cetera. So the best place for people to reach out to me is go to my website, extraordinaryadvisors.com, send me an email, todd@extraordinaryadvisors.com, and say you'd like to have about 30 minutes of my time. I'm happy to sit with you, talk through what your issues are, and help you create a plan. And typically that can be done again in 30 minutes, and no charge for that, and see if we're a good fit from there.
Very fascinating, great information. I really appreciate you taking the time to come on today and share all of these great tips with our listeners. And the book, The Job Search Process, is still out and available, I take it, as it will be forever?
Yeah. It's so funny. I checked in this morning. I just sold 4 this morning. It's been really fun to watch the sales move around graduation season. A lot of people give it as graduation gifts. And I've been telling you, but promoting it a little bit more because of the current times. And then my next book, From Suck to Success, is coming out at the end of the year about the entrepreneurial journey. So look out for that as well.
Todd Palmer, thanks so much. Really appreciate you coming on and helping us out today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after this. So please stay with us.
And now the Exit Coach Radio Show proudly presents the All-Star Review, a compilation of one-minute highlights from past guests. Hear more one-minute highlights and full interviews from these guests at ExitCoachRadio.com.
When your business value is wrapped up in your client list, what's the most important thing you can do to drive the value of your business? We asked expert Stacy McKibben.
If you don't have really strong, client relation management tools, CRMs, as they're lovingly referred to, if you don't have tools like that in your business, it's going to be very difficult to transition it over. As a matter of fact, your next buyer is going to use that as a reason to drive down your sale price. Absolutely, one of the biggest areas of opportunity that we see in professional services businesses are going back to your existing and previous clients. Oftentimes, we just forget that they don't necessarily know the full breadth of services that we provide and how they can use us or even refer us to their friends and family. So that is a big win in most businesses, is just starting there. And it's very difficult to do if you don't have a good system in place with which to do it.
One of the most common ways a business is sold is through something called an earnout. And we asked for information and an example from business broker Chris Bond.
What buyers want to have happen is they want a seller to prove the actual value of the business by having them be patient and waiting for a piece of the payout. So in other words, once the transition period has happened, say 6, 12, 18, or 24 months, the buyer will make additional payments with the comfort that, okay, it is what you said it is. Had a very creative deal earlier this year where down payment was made for about 80% of the deal. A bank stepped in for a percentage of the deal. The seller actually financed another small percentage of the deal. And the earnout comes in years 3, 4, and 5. So everybody's pulling in the same direction, making sure the first 2 years go very smoothly.
What are some of the challenges for leaders in this knowledge-based economy? Here's CEO Coach Bill Anton.
The person that has the most influence over the entire organization is the person that leads the organization. And transforming that person exponentially influences change. My training as a psychologist, my understanding about the kinds of organizations that are going to be successful in the future are going to be organizations that realize that knowledge is their product and that knowledge can only be created by enrollment, not by compliance. And so the task of the leader of the future is to transform the people that work in the organization so that they want to give their best and so that they're willing to offer ideas and perspectives that create knowledge and innovation for the organization.
Medical insurance is a big part of your budget. How do you contain those costs? We ask benefits expert Rhett Bray.
We'll talk about wellness is how we can start to communicate the importance of the wellness and that we give the people and the employees the opportunities to do things that will help them to become healthier. We start to educate them on the importance of annual physicals. We start to educate them on preventative care. Women do this quite well. Men have a tendency to wait till body parts don't work and then they go, which can be late. And it's interesting. We take better care of our car. We change the oil. We see the lamp light comes on, and for a lot of us, we don't do the maintenance that we should do on a regular basis. That will identify a lot of issues that people have that now you can start to address either through medication, through exercise or diet. There are just a few key areas that you can identify that will drive these higher costs.
Okay, so we've heard the term before, treat your business like an investment. It'll be a lot easier to sell down the road. What exactly does that mean? We asked an expert, Don Berzin.
Many of us in the field encourage owners to look at their business as an investment. Some owners understand that concept, but many do not. I mean, for a number of them, they see their business as either a job, a cash machine, a passion, or an extension of who they are. And the term investment sounds a little too removed for them to relate to. And we also let it be known that a business is actually easier to sell when it has a passive ownership. I mean, an owner who is not personally critical to maintaining future cash flows. But let's face it, I mean, one of the last terms that ever come to mind when we think about most entrepreneurs is passive. You know, these people are doers, they make things happen, and sitting on the sidelines is not something that many of them want to do at any stage of their career.
At ExitCoachRadio.com, we're interviewing over 100 top advisors to get you one-minute tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new content daily at 6 a.m. and 1 p.m. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
Why would you have a revocable living trust instead of a will? Here's attorney Matt Amaro.
One of the main reasons that you would consider doing a revocable trust versus just having a will is avoiding what we would call a probate process, which is a court proceeding to distribute a family estate, which can be very expensive and legal fees, court fees, and just involves a lot of court involvement that can be pretty painful. So by using a trust, you can get out of that. Now, if your assets aren't high enough, that's one way you may be able to avoid probate without a trust. And the other way is you may have assets that are able to pass to beneficiaries outside of a trust and outside of probate, even if you don't have a trust. But when you have real property, you usually won't be able to avail yourself of those two exceptions to staying out of probate.
How do most people decide it's time to start exit planning, and what's on their mind when they do? Here's Jim Immel.
Long-term is really interesting. I use the analogy of the light switch. Sometimes these business owners don't think about it, and then all of a sudden they wake up one day and they just want to turn the light switch off, and they go from being passionate 100% into the game, and then all of a sudden something starts feeling heavy. Maybe it's a personal situation that's happened, but they literally turn the light switch off. Most of the people that you and I work with, it's more like a dimmer switch. They just don't do it that quick. They do it over time. But what really a lot of them are thinking about is, how do I transition myself out of the leadership position, provide other people opportunity to get in that leadership position, so the business is being prepared to transition from a position of strength and not weakness.
People are nervous about stocks and bonds these days. What's the outlook for income real estate? We asked real estate expert Scott Tamkin.
I'm a firm believer that income property will grow wealth over time. And there are parts of Los Angeles where income property is still affordable. The west side of L.A. doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but there are parts of L.A. where there are still opportunities. And I firmly believe that, particularly in some of the outlying areas, the gentrification will continue and people will want to rent in those areas, particularly as public transportation expands. People have some extra money.
Sorry for that programming glitch there. Hey, welcome, everybody. Thanks so much for joining me. Pleasure to have you with me. My next guest, we're going to be talking about some very important tax-based information, especially if you're a business owner and you own a building. And I know a lot of you do that listen to this show. In a lot of cases, the building can be worth more than the business. I've seen that many, many times over. So it's important to have some strategies for your business. So Joel Dobrin, who is Joel Dobrin, based in Camarillo, California, and his team are joining us to talk about cost segregation initiatives. It's a true and still somewhat underutilized hidden gem of the tax code. Cost seg, as it's called, is a powerful strategy available to owners of commercial and residential rental property. So let's talk about it. Joel, thanks so much for joining me today and welcome to the show.
Bill, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and I very much appreciate the opportunity.
My pleasure, absolutely. It's a great information to bring to our listeners. And what I'd like to do is ask you to maybe start with a little bit of background about you and your team that you work with.
Sure. Well, first off, just a little personal background on myself. I was born and raised in Long Branch, New Jersey, just north of Asbury Park. For those of you that follow the Garden State Parkway, that would be exit 105. I grew up in a wonderful family. I had two sisters, and my growing up revolved around basketball and chasing Bruce Springsteen around before he catapulted to stardom. It was interesting that he, 45 years ago this week, was Born to Run. So I think if we all think about that, some time has passed. So basketball, it is, in fact. Basketball took me to a career to be able to play both college, and then I also had the opportunity to play overseas. I played in Israel for a bit and was actually a member of the Maccabi team, the United States team. We won a gold medal back in 1982, which also seems like two lifetimes ago. And I originally got started in business in the medical equipment finance arena in physical therapy. And just to hit fast forward, about 15 years ago, through a contact there, I was introduced to cost segregation. I had not heard about it, but it fascinated me because the gentleman that suggested I look into it, he says, Joel, you're working with these medical professionals. They probably own their building, some of them. And that's what got started. And I got introduced. It was really serendipitous. I got introduced to two terrific guys that I have been able to work with close to now 15 years. I'll be celebrating my 30th wedding anniversary in December. We've got two daughters, 26 and 24, that are both working for Hulu. And right now, because of tax reform and all that is taking place, the benefits for owners are greater than they've ever been before. And it's just clearly a strategy that people should take a close look at.
Now, I know you don't do this alone. You also work with a couple gentlemen, and one of them, as a matter of fact, is in Baton Rouge, where, of course, the Hurricane Laura is taking a toll right now. We want to give a shout-out to everybody out there and wish the very best for them. Tell us a little bit more about your team.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that really separates us is we bring both we bring a few components. My role is I handle the business development and project management, but so important is the tax implications, the accounting implications, as well as the construction implications and understanding, because this is a very detailed and specialized process to be able to go in, tear these buildings down, and basically rebuild them piece by piece by piece. And that's the part that Dante Romano heads up on the construction side. And then Kurt Gautreaux, who is a CPA himself, had a tax practice for many years and sold that when he became fascinated with cost segregation. And Kurt is recognized nationally. He's actually the chairman of the Technical Standards Committee for the American Society of Cost Segregation Professionals. He's really at the forefront of the rules and the regs that continue to evolve and develop. And for us, for many of the CPAs that we work with, he plays a key role in being able to take the results of our work and then assist our clients' CPAs with then taking and integrating our results into the tax return. And so collectively, we feel very good about the totality of the service that we bring. And I think also, and we may touch on this a little later, most importantly, is that we stand behind the work and we're always there in the event that questions should come up.
So that brings up a really good point, and that is, Joel, that of course, most of our listeners, all of our listeners that are business owners have a CPA. They have someone that does their taxes and handles that kind of area for them. And yet this remains something that's called the hidden gem of the tax code. Why do you think that so many business owners have not heard of cost segregation from their advisors? And who can benefit most from cost segregation?
Well, I think that what we find is that there are many that have heard of it. That, you know, if you say cost segregation, oh yes, I know that. But it's almost like if you took sand and put it in the top of an hourglass. And the more that we drill into this, there are some that are aware of it or have heard of it, but there are it just dwindles down as it relates to people truly recognizing how impactful this can actually be to the different types of properties and scenarios that it can be applicable. And I think that really sharp CPAs recognize that they want to be in a position where they have to have the confidence of who in fact is actually going to do this work. Because ultimately, it's the CPA that is going to sign that tax return. And they want to be absolutely certain that the quality and the standards that go into this are reflective of their work and their professionalism. So I think that, again, the importance of awareness across the board in terms of both this being available for people that have purchased or, again, with tax reform, the fact that it's applicable for people that have improved property as well, and understanding the nuances of tax reform, understanding the nuances of the CARES Act. I think that what happens is, as with many things, there's so many rule changes, there's so many updates, that really it's impossible for people to stay abreast of everything. And I think that's where the relationships that we have formed, people truly appreciate that that we've got all the bases covered as it relates to this application.
Really good input and advice there, and I like the way you say that about what the reason that someone's CPA might not have brought it up is that they may know about it, but they don't have the confidence in a firm to do a good job that they'd feel comfortable signing off on. As a CPA, I think that's really critical and important. So is there a building, a cost basis threshold needed for this to make sense? I mean, could some of our listeners identify whether this makes sense just on that basis?
Sure. It's a great question. And I think you get answers that may range across the board depending upon the firm. But for us, because we are a smaller boutique firm, cost segregation is our sole focus. It is all we do. And frankly, we recognize that the benefits for a small business owner on a smaller piece of property, they can be just as, if maybe not even more important, given the times that we're in, the ability to save money, save tax right now. It's critical. So to come back to your initial question, we will look at properties with a building basis, separated from the land, but a building basis of at least $800,000. Now, we know that some folks in our world, you know, it needs to be a building that's $2 million or $3 million, or they frankly don't even want to have a discussion. But we'll take the time to assess it. We actually just recently completed a rental property, a residential rental down in Palm Desert, and the basis of the building was about $650,000, which a little bit rare, but it was just a great property with lots of improvements, with lots of great features. So that was at the lower end of the scale, and by going through cost-segging that property, we were able to create $112,000 of accelerated depreciation for that owner. And so that meant a lot to her. It's going to be very helpful. So that's at one end of the scale. At the other end of the scale right now, we're involved in a $40 million apartment complex that is going to generate $5.7 million of accelerated depreciation that the owner is going to take advantage of. So the impact is significant, but I would say, generally speaking, Bill, $1 million or just under in basis, and then on up from there for purchases. I would also say that for improvements, because of the tax rules, and we really don't have time to get into it today, but anybody that maybe has an existing property, a building they may have purchased years ago and just now decided to improve that property, if they have spent $500,000 or more in improvements, worth taking a look at and exploring, because the benefits could be significant in terms of immediate tax savings. And just, I think, one other quick thing as to why this is so important. You know, we're in a challenging environment, of course, across the board for all businesses in 2020 with COVID. But those same businesses that are struggling now, they may have had very strong 2019 income years, and now they're faced with looking at a 2019 tax obligation that has to be figured out. And that's where we've been able to come in and deliver benefit that has helped save these property owners significant amounts of tax right now.
That's great. And, you know, there are, of course, others out there that are promoting that they do cost seg, among other different things. You guys are, you're called Cost Segregation Initiative, so that's what you specialize in. So that's all you look at, it sounds like. Is there a difference in providers, and what have you seen out there? Have you looked at other people's proposals or ideas, and what do you see that makes Cost Segregation Initiatives stand out?
Well, I think, just as you mentioned, there are other folks certainly that do this. There are, as in any profession, in any industry, there are some that do a good job and maybe some that not as much, and some that will perhaps cut corners to do things not within the standards that we believe this work should be done. And I think sometimes it boils down that to you get what you pay for in terms of quality and the work that comes behind it. What sets us apart truly is that Kurt and Dante, they are two of less than, the last we checked, two of less than 35 individuals nationwide who have met the requirements and gone through what is necessary to receive the designation of being recognized as certified cost segregation professionals by the American Society of Cost Segregation Professionals. And it was a tremendous amount of work, peer review, test taking, a submission of reports that goes into this. And I would say that for people that are out there as they explore this, really the most important thing is you want to know that when all is said and done, who is actually doing the work? Do you know that? And do you know who is actually signing that report? Because in the event that the IRS ever takes a look, the first thing they are going to look at are those two things: who did the work and what are their qualifications. And, you know, it reminds me of what the jeweler told me at my wife's and my 20th wedding anniversary, when he said, "Remember, Joel, The bitterness of poor quality lingers far longer than the sweetness of a low price. And I think I relate that to the fact that people have to make a decision. They have to make a decision. Are they willing to pay for quality in a study, or do they just want to roll the dice and hope that maybe the IRS never takes a look? You know, we often say you can put anything on a tax return, cost seg or otherwise, and it's fine until you have to speak to it and address it, and then it could potentially become a problem. So,
yeah,
more about
good point.
Quality and standards.
Yeah. I always tell people you pay for quality and you wince once. So,
well said. If with your permission, I will use that.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. So, one of the ways, I guess, that a client could kind of figure out is by having some kind of a benchmark overview. And you guys will do that, right? Is that a first step for a client? Usually, probably a phone conversation to kind of get the lay of the situation, lay of the land, if you will, and then to provide some kind of a benchmark overview?
That's exactly right. And we think it's very important to just recognize and state the fact that no two properties are alike. And there could be similarities, especially when you're dealing with, you know, if you're dealing in an apartment building situation, yes, there could be duplication there. But ultimately, no two properties are exactly the same. And we believe it's important, and what we will do is we want to take the time in advance to be able to assess and share information with people that is specific to their property. And after close to 15 years of doing this work, we have enough experience where if we just get some basic information about the property, when it was purchased, the purchase price, have there been improvements made, then what we'll do, just as you said, Bill, we'll put together a benchmark illustration that will give a general idea. And we, when I say general, it's because we're conservative in nature when we put out these initial overviews. And this will give folks an understanding of the what we anticipate to be the tax savings benefit along with our fees to do the work. And I want to be very clear, it's just as important to us because mm-hmm. we want to be absolutely certain that we know that if people look to engage us, we know we're going to deliver benefit to them. We are not just interested in looking to gain fees. We don't want to do that, and humbly and thankfully, we don't need to do that. So everything is done up front at no cost, no obligation. We want to make sure that we know it's the right fit for the client, for their tax professional, as well as for us.
What information would you prefer that people have readily available for that initial discussion or call before they get engaged so you can figure out if it's a right fit for both of you?
So ideally, if somebody has the ideal scenario would be to have a copy of an appraisal. If they don't have an appraisal for whatever reason, then initially we would just need to get the address of the property. We'd need to get the month and date that they purchased it, the purchase price of the building. And then again, if they've made any improvements, then we'd like to know what improvements were made and approximately how much they spent in doing so. And with that, we're able to get an initial snapshot put together. And I think also at that point, we can determine based on what we see them, we say, hey, do you have, we should probably, let's see if we can even drill in and take a closer look at things.
Excellent. Now, of course, if someone out there listening wants to get in touch with you, it's pretty easy to do so. What would you prefer? Would you prefer them to check out your website at costseginitiatives.com or email you at Joel, J-O-E-L, at costseginitiatives.com? Or give you a call?
They can certainly email. I know some people email is the way, but I'm still somebody that I enjoy talking with people. So if that somebody wants to pick up the phone and call, I'm happy to take the phone call and answer their questions. So phone call or email, whatever is their preference. Some people like to text. They can text. And whatever works for them works for me in terms of initial communication.
And that phone number is 805-680-3834. 805-680-3834. And, of course, all of this will be in our show notes at exacoachradio.com. But, you know, you might just want to call Joel and talk to him about chasing Bruce Springsteen around New Jersey. That could be just an interesting conversation, or the gold medal story. There's a lot that you might want to talk about. But I think in this day and age, everybody's looking for the, you know, what can they get back to help their business? And cost segregation is one of those things. If you've been thinking about it, if it's been on the fence, maybe you've talked to, with your CPA and they've said, I just don't know anybody that does a good job of that, and I'm nervous about it. Now you know someone, Joel Dobrin. Thanks so much, Joel, for joining me, and I really appreciate you taking the time to share this information with our listeners. Very helpful.
Very, thank you, Bill. I very much appreciate it. Pleasure is all mine, and you're right. There are some good Bruce Springsteen stories for anybody that wants to call.
I'll probably be calling you about that. I have a good one, too. Look forward to talking to you again sometime, Joel. Thanks so much, and we hope all the best for Kurt and his family in Baton Rouge as they battle with Hurricane Laura.
Thank you so very much. I'll pass it along, and we really do appreciate it.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after this, so please stay with us.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.